This is The Thirsty Developer, episode number 9 for January 21st, 2008's Cyclomatic Complexity. Welcome everyone to episode number 9 of The Thirsty Developer. I'm Dave Boss, coming to you straight from Studio DG, and up in Studio M is my cohort, Larry Clarkin. Hey Larry, how you doing?
Doing great, Dave. How are you?
Great. So this week, we're actually, our guest is Mark Strawmeyer from Crow Chizik, and Mark's going to be talking to us about some of the his team's usage of Visual Studio Team System on some of the projects they're working on down there. But before we actually get to the interview, we got some business to take care of first. But actually, Larry, I got something to ask you. You had an interesting post on your blog this week, something about going a week without Flash. What was that all about?
Yeah, I think we all take Flash for granted, the fact that it's always going to be there, you know, installed as, you know,
when you're developing. So Flash being the Adobe Flash player that, you know, is utilized by many websites.
Correct. Okay. You know, it's the backbone of a lot of websites like, you know, YouTube. It's also used heavily on the Microsoft.com site. You know, it's pretty much used, you know, here and there and everywhere, right? And I decided to go for a week without Flash to see if I could survive. You know, has it become an essential part of the web, or is it still just kind of an added-on bonus thing at this point? So I decided to go for 7 days without it being installed.
So what was the conclusion?
Well, my conclusion was that you can actually survive without Flash, but you may not want to. You know, it definitely enhances a lot of the web experience. There was a lot of sites that I went to, particularly consumer product companies, where their entire site is built in Flash, and I just flat out couldn't get any information out of the site. But I was able to find the information I was looking for on other sites.
So it's kind of good and bad, right? It's good that Flash, you know, both technologies like Flash and Silverlight provide you that extended user experience on the web. You know, the web experience, you know, you can only go so far with what the browser provides you, but we have things like a Flash too and Silverlight to extend those experiences. And, you know, some websites actually take that a little bit too far, like you said, where they build their entire sort of website, if you will, in Flash. So if you don't have Flash installed, you can't get to that website. Yeah, you can't do anything on that website.
Yeah, I think the key is that, you know, you should always give an alternative to, you know, any rich internet application, you know, be it Silverlight or Flash. The good practice applies to both so that somebody who's not, you know, running with the plugin or they're running with an old version of the plugin can still have, you know, at least a somewhat pleasing experience, you know, with your website.
That's right. So speaking of pleasing experiences, I'm gonna have to do a shout out right now. So if anybody's been to the thirstydeveloper.com website, that is a, you know, thirstydeveloper.com is sort of in a transitional state right now, if you will. So I'm actually doing a call out to any web designers out there who would like to help us with a thirstydeveloper.com extreme makeover. So actually what I would like to do is, if there's any budding web designers out there, I don't know whether you're in high school or in college or somebody who's just getting into web design and want a little bit of experience, shoot me an email, thirstydeveloper@live.com, and you know, see if you'd like to help us out, you know, kind of, you know, pretty up, if you will, the thirstydeveloper.com website. So there's certainly some work that needs to be done there. You know, Larry, you know, both Larry and I are developers and architects. We're not web designers. You know, we could certainly put something together. It's not going to look nice, but if with the help of somebody who's looking to get into web design, I think we can make it actually a pleasing experience. So a call out to any budding web designers, you know, reach us at thirstydeveloperlive.com, and let's make Thirsty Developer a good experience for everybody.
Amen,
right.
Brother.
That's right. So Larry, with that, I guess we got some events we got coming up here we should talk about, huh?
Yes, sir.
All right. So once again, we've kind of mentioned this in the past couple of shows, but we got upcoming here in Chicago an event called Sleepless in Chicago. And what this is, it's an event for essentially SharePoint developers where it's kind of training, but there's also a developer competition involved. And that's arguably the most important part of this, right? And we're actually looking for some more participants for this developer competition for Sleepless in Chicago. And if you're looking for to sling your SharePoint skills or what have you, you know, definitely go to infusion.com/sleepless. And what they're doing, Infusion is a company based out of New York, and they're doing kind of this sleepless roadshow in the cities like Washington, Atlanta, Dallas, Los Angeles, and Silicon Valley. And what it is they do a little bit of training around SharePoint. They have, you know, SharePoint MVPs and some folks from Microsoft kind of talking about the product and some of the technologies around SharePoint. And they kind of, you know, build up around a problem statement and kind of hand that off to the different development teams. They kind of go off and build a solution around that problem statement and kind of come back and do like a little, you know, best of show, if you will. And the winners of each sleepless event in each city is going to get an all-expense-paid trip to the Office Developer Conference in San Jose, California. And there, they will compete with the other winners from the other sleepless cities, and they will have a chance at winning a trip to Redmond plus an Alaskan cruise or a home theater or a Las Vegas racing weekend. So those are some pretty amazing prizes. So if you want to get involved, definitely go check out infusion.com/sleepless. The event in Chicago is February 1st and 2nd, but also, you know, go to the website infusion.com/sleepless once again to check out for the sleepless events in Washington, Atlanta, Dallas, Los Angeles, or Silicon Valley. Speaking of the Office Developer Conference, this is the premier conference for anybody wanting to learn more about SharePoint and developing on the Office System platform. And Bill Gates is actually keynoting this event along with some of the other leaders in the Office and Live platform teams at Redmond. And I would resonate to guess that this is one of Bill's last keynotes before he officially retires this summer. So if you're a SharePoint developer, or you want to learn more about developing on SharePoint and the Office System platform, definitely check out the Office Developer Conference coming to San Jose. You can register at www.odc2008.com and tell them that the Thirsty Developer sent you.
So, Dave, coming up this week, we've also got a great event called the Silicon Prairie Social. We're sponsoring the event, and we're going to be there, you know, with a table demonstrating some great technology. This is a fun event. It's a chance to mix and mingle with other technology-minded folks and to share a beer with them. We're kicking in an Xbox, you know, as a raffle prize as part of the event. Also, we're going to have a TV set up with an Xbox 360, and we're going to be able to play some Rock Band and some Guitar Hero. And maybe, just maybe, we'll bring out the podcasting equipment and we can, you know, find some people to interview while we're out there.
Right. So anybody in Chicago, you know, certainly, you know, check out SiliconPrairieSocial.com, and we'd love to see you out there.
Yep. And also coming up in February, we're going to be kicking off our Arc Ready series of events. This is a quarterly event for software architects, and the topic this time is going to be service lifecycle management. And we'll talk a little bit more about that as it gets closer. But for right now, you can go out to ArcReady.com. That's ArcReady.com, and look to see where it's coming in an area near you, and go ahead and register for the event.
Right. So also, if you're a developer, we're also kicking off our DevCare series this month as well. And, you know, go out to devcares.com and check out what cities are coming near you. And the topics, you know, around this month are building secure web applications, as well as building office-based applications with Visual Studio 2008. So go to devcares.com and check that out. And also, don't forget, the MSDN events team just kicked off their new quarter of dates, and they're coming to a city near you. Check out msdnevents.com, and you'll find out that the topics this time around is IIS7 for developers and extending ASP.NET 2.0 application services. So go to msdnevents.com.
And we're also keeping our eye on the launch event, Dave, coming up. The Visual Studio SQL Server and Windows Server launch events that are coming up. HeroesHappenHere.com is the place to get all the information about events across the United States and the world. Locally here, the first event will be on March 11th at Chicago at McCormick Place. And I think you and I are going to do some live broadcasting from the event.
Yep, that's right. So if anybody's, from what I understand, they just opened up the registration for the launch events. So definitely go to HeroesHappenHere.com. And, yes, we will be broadcasting live from the Chicago launch event. So if you're coming up to Chicago one, you know, stop by and say hi, and maybe we can get some get you on the air. But, you know, so it seems like there's a lot going on, Larry.
Yeah, I'm looking at my calendar, and it's pretty well booked.
Yeah,
lots of opportunities to record people.
That's right, absolutely. So we'll be definitely got some great shows coming up around these different events. Actually, what I'd like to know is anyone who's listening going to Mix or South by Southwest? If so, shoot me an email, thirstydeveloperlive.com, and maybe we can do something like a Thirsty Developer meetup or happy hour or something. We'll be bringing our podcasting equipment, and we'll be recording some shows from both Mix and South by Southwest. So if you're going, we'd love to get you on the show and have a good time. So shoot us an email at thirstydeveloperlive.com. All right, so those are some events that we got coming up, and moving right along to a blog you should know. Now, Larry, I feel something's missing here. We need some theme music or something for a blog you should know.
Yeah, this is quickly becoming my favorite segment, and I think it deserves a, you know, theme music of its own.
Right, so if any, you know, we're certainly not talented enough to come up with theme music. So if any of the listeners, you know, you want to throw something together, a little bit of intro or something or theme music for a blog you should know, you can send that to us at thirstydeveloperalive.com. And so a blog you should know, it's essentially a segment where both Larry and I pick a blog or a blog entry that we came across during the week that we want to highlight during the show. So this week, since we're talking to Mark Strahlmeier about Visual Studio Team System, I actually want to point out a blog called teamsystemrocks.com. And this is a collection of blogs all around Team System. And my good friend Mickey Guzet, he's actually the editor over there. And Mickey periodically actually posts entries around some of the great VSTS content that he comes across when he's out surfing the blogosphere, and he calls it VSTS links. So it's kind of a great way to kind of keep an eye on what's going on in the VSTS community. And there's a lot of people who are posting to TeamSystemRocks.com who are actually Team System MVPs. And actually, I just got an email today from Mickey, who's teamed up with Paul Hacker. And Paul Hacker is a Team System MVP out of Indianapolis who produces the Team Foundation Server Times that you can find at TFSTimes.com. And this is kind of a newsletter around Team System. And both of them just joined up, and they're actually now doing a podcast called Radio TFS. So definitely check that out. Go to TeamSystemRocks.com. You can find all the blog content as well as the podcast Radio TFS. So Larry, what's your blog that we should know this week?
So Dave, my blog that I think you should know is called The Pulpit by Robert Crinley. He's the kind of technology editor over at PBS, and it started out actually in 1997, and it really wasn't a blog. It was actually a weekly column, but it has since been actually converted over to more of a blog style. I think it's really cool because, you know, he publishes an article every week, and he also publishes an audio edition of it. So, you know, if you think that, you know, reading a blog is just a little too painful, you can actually download the podcast and actually listen to his blog, you know, on your Zune or your iPod. And what's cool about it is he covers, you know, all range of technology things. You know, not just Microsoft stuff, of course. You know, he talks a lot about Apple, Google, and he's really one of the most forward-thinking guys in our industry. So check it out. It's pbs.org/Cringley. That's C-R-I-N-G-E-L-Y.
Now, Larry, I came across Robert Cringley a number of years ago. I was actually walking through a PBS store in the mall, you know, kind of like how they have these Discovery stores today. Well, they used to have PBS stores. I don't know if they have them anymore. But I was walking through the store, and I was looking at their DVD collection, and I ran across a DVD that kind of caught my eye. And you'll know why by the title. It was called Triumph of the Nerds.
It's an absolute classic, Dave.
It is a classic. It's got dated, you know, some dated footage of Steve Jobs, Bill Gates, and kind of the thought leaders behind the PC industry. And it's really kind of a history of the industry, you know, back in the day, kind of all the way up to, I'd say, about the mid, you know, early mid 90s or so. And it was definitely a very interesting sort of documentary. And you can find that, actually, they still have it at Amazon.com. So go look for Triumph of the Nerds, An Irreverent History of the PC Industry. It's a great DVD. So definitely check that out. So that leads us into this week's interview with Mark Strawmeyer. Mark is a C-Sharp MVP, and he works for Crowe Chizik down in Indianapolis, Indiana. And Larry, you were down in Indianapolis last week, and you had a chance to meet up with Mark.
Yes, I did. Mark is the practice lead for the Microsoft practice there at Crowe Chizik. And Crowe is normally thought of as an accounting firm. You know, that's kind of what, you know, they're known for. But they actually do custom software development for a lot of their clients also. And one of the things that they do that's a little different from, you know, a lot of consulting firms is they'll actually take the customer's work and do it at their offices there at Crowe. And this leads to a lot of opportunities to do some fine-tuning to their process, right? They can pick the tools that they want to use. They can follow their methodology. And I wanted to capture some of those best practices that they use and share it with our listeners.
Great. So let's listen in to your interview with Mark Strawmeyer.
Hi, this is Larry Clarkin, and we're recording this live in Indianapolis, Indiana. I'm here with Mark Strawmeyer. Mark, can you say hello?
Hello.
We're at Mark's office here at Crowe Chizik in Indianapolis. And what are we going to talk about today, Mark?
We are going to talk about some of the cool new features in the Team Suite edition of Visual Studio 2008.
Cool. Now, you guys do a lot of on-site development here, you know, in your offices, both in Indianapolis and, you know, kind of across the United States. I know you got an office in Louisville and in Oak Brook,
correct,
Illinois.
Louisville, Oak Brook, South Bend, even some other remote satellite offices as well.
And not a lot of consulting companies do this, but this is kind of an interesting good practice where, you know, you'll go and you'll meet with the customer on their site, get the requirements, you know, do some design document, you know. When you get approval to actually build the application, though, you kind of leave the client alone. You know, you come back to your office, and you've got a development center that's set up to actually do that development. And that's what you guys are doing here with Crowe, right?
Correct. I mean, we've got folks that do spend on site time with the client for that face time, that customer experience. But really, from a developer standpoint, we've got our environments set up, configured. We've got our methodologies and practices and procedures and things that we follow. So we really try to, where it makes sense, bring all that in-house to work on that within our environment versus having 6, 8, 10 or more people go take over a large environment within the client space. We like to bring that stuff in-house and work on it
Yeah, because
that can be a drain on the customer's, you know, resources. But, you know, and I don't know if I've seen any, you know, university papers or official research on this, but it seems like when you do that, you know, off-site development, the team can actually be more productive in a lot of ways because, like you said, the environment's kind of set up for it, you know, and the team is kind of isolated from the politics and the day-to-day grind at the customer site.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, I've been doing consulting for a little bit over 10 years now, and I've worked for anywhere from, you know, 5-10 person government agencies up to really large multinational organizations. So I've seen anywhere from very little red tape all the way up to, okay, you got to sit and wait for a month for a phone to show up or a network connectivity, et cetera. So by doing development off-site helps avoid all that. We don't have to deal with accounts set up and getting phones and desk space and all that type of stuff.
Yeah, back when I was in consulting, I actually waited for an IP address for 2 weeks. Had the network connectivity, but didn't have an ability to connect to the network.
Not to digress too far, but the funniest I recall seeing was I worked at a client that was a shop that were I wanted to move a monitor, a 17-inch monitor, but it was a union shop. And so I had to literally file a request to get someone to move my 17-inch monitor from one side of my desk to the other. So here I am at this point. I was, you know, 20-something years old. I had a little 17-inch monitor, not too big. There was a lady that literally could not have been under 70 years old that showed up to move this monitor for me. So they're worried about me getting hurt, and I'm worrying about this little lady dying while she's trying to move my monitor. So needless to say, I convinced her to supervise me moving the monitor from one side of the desk to the other.
We won't tell anybody about that. But, I mean, that's really one of the advantages. You don't have to deal with all those things.
Right.
Your environment's set up. So when you have, you know, 5 or 6, you know, consultants ready to work on the project, they are literally ready to work on the project. Monday morning at 8 a.m., you know, they're actually, you know, producing code.
Yeah, at that point, we've got our environment set up and all the requirements and things, so we're ready to go and focus on building and adding value from the start.
So one of the things that you've done with your development center is you kind of got some of the best tools available to you. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm a Microsoft guy, so I'm saying it. Visual Studio 2008 and Team Foundation Server are pretty awesome tools, you know, for team development. We wanted to talk about some of the specific new features in Visual Studio 2008 that are making your development center, you know, consultants more productive.
Yeah, it's great. I am not a Microsoft person, and I would agree with you 100%. The Visual Studio tools, there's none that can compete with them. They're just outstanding tool sets. So specifically within the 2008 environment, some of the things that we're really excited about are some of the code metrics and the code analysis tools that are now baked into the developer edition of the team suite. The ability to do that quick metric analysis and code analysis to look at, you know, how maintainable is your code, how much code complexity is there, the performance attributes of it, really quickly write unit tests and even do performance tests against those. It's just unparalleled to have that type of stuff baked into a tool set you already use and are already familiar with. Some of those things have been available, but it'd take 3 or 4 or 5 different tools that are also expensive and hard to use, but now it's all within an environment you know. You right-click and say, you know, run code analysis or run code metrics, and there you are.
Yeah, and let's just step back for a second, because I know a lot of our listeners, you know, are confused by the number of SKUs that we've got available. Microsoft likes to do that. We like to, you know, create SKUs. I think there's somebody that gets paid, you know, per SKU that gets created. And I think we confuse a lot of people because we've got these, like, quasi-names for things. I mean, Visual Studio itself is not a product. Visual Studio is a family. And there's multiple editions for that. And I think probably most of the people are familiar with, like, Visual Studio Standard or Visual Studio Professional is what most people seek. And they're both great tools. The team system SKUs, and there are 5 of them, there's 4 individual ones that are done by role. You're talking about some of the features of the developer role. There's an architect one, there's a testing one, and then there's one for database professionals, or data dude, as we like to call it internally. So there's these individual roles that are available that add features on top of Visual Studio Pro. Mm-hmm. There's also, you can get the, you know, kind of the give me everything package, which is a suite product that is the software architect, the software developer, the tester, and the database professional all rolled into one. But you're talking about some specific new features that have been added to Visual Studio 2008 Developer Edition. Mm-hmm. One of the other changes is you mentioned unit testing. And that's actually been moved down from the developer SKU into the
It's a professional SKU now as well.
Yeah, and how do you feel about that?
I think it's great. I mean, the nice thing about the unit testing stuff was, I mean, you could get that before with N-Unit and some of the stuff that was available to snap in. So I think it made all the sense in the world to go ahead and pull that down to the Pro, to the Visual Studio 2000 Pro SKUs, or excuse me, 2008 SKUs. So I think that's a great addition, and actually is certainly something that was long overdue.
Yeah, and it was a real value-added feature for the developer edition in the past. I mean, that was the, you know, that was the kind of the least investment you can make in Visual Studio to get that functionality. I think it's great that the product team said, you know, unit testing is so important, and there's a lot of people who will do it if it's integrated into the product that won't necessarily go out and, you know, grab InUnit or one of the other unit testing frameworks and, you know, work with it separately outside of the tool. So the fact that it's there, I think, is going to improve the quality of the code in general, because it is there and it's just, you know, a right click and, you know, add unit test type feature. But to make the SKU valuable, of course, we had to add additional functionality because we're basically giving away unit testing features now. So, you know, you mentioned some of those, and one of the ones that I really like is cyclomatic complexity. Mm-hmm. Can you kind of just explain what that is?
Sure. The cyclomatic complexity has a lot to do, if you think about just, you know, several lines of code you've written, the number of branches or steps that that code could particularly take, whether it's a loop or conditional logic, each, if it's a, you know, if then else type of statement, each one of those represents a different branch. So if you think about, okay, I've got, you know, if then else, well, that means I've got a couple of cases already that there's two cases right there. If I have a simple if, you know, else if type of statement that have to be tested when it comes to things like a unit testing or something. So the higher the cyclomatic complexity, the end result of that means the more difficult it is to write unit tests or to actually test your code. So the higher cyclomatic complexity, the more complexity there then is in your code.
And it's also, I know it's mathematically computed that it actually does static analysis on the code, and every time that it identifies something as a branch, you know, it adds to the actual, you know, complexity. And the higher the number, the more complex, correct?
Sure. Yes.
Yeah. But I think, you know, more than that, it's just a really good rule of thumb. The higher the cyclomatic complexity is, the tougher it is for somebody who hasn't seen the code, didn't work with it as it was being developed, to pick up and maintain it. Would you agree with that?
I would agree 100%. I mean, again, that comes back even to that testing part of the more branches, the higher the complexity, the harder it is to identify issues and understand it. It means chances are you've got more code, or the code that you've got is really complex.
Yeah. So some of the things you talked about, if-then-elses, do case statements, do they increase cyclomatic complexity?
Yeah, I mean, really, regardless of whatever code you have, even if it's just a straight sequential set of code, there is different branches or various ways that all that's computed. And the nice thing is you touched on the mathematical complexity, the computations that go behind it. The great thing as a developer is I don't have to worry about any of that. You guys at Microsoft paid all the smart people to figure that stuff out. I just get to benefit from it and use it. So I right-click, it spits out a number, and it'll give you the red, yellow, green, even the nice little indicators to give you an idea of whether you got higher or lower issues or where to drill into. So from a time standpoint, I can run that real quick within a minute, have it form an opinion of my code without having to do a detailed and in-depth analysis, then just go focus on the trouble areas and make decisions about, is this too code too complex? Do I want to refactor it and make any changes, or is it acceptable as it is?
So how do you guys, you know, we've kind of talked about the theory of it, the Russian scientist who developed these formulas. And actually, I looked in the Wikipedia article, and it really was Russian scientists who built most of these formulas. And there are actually multiple, you know, dozens of formulas on how to compute cyclomatic complexity. Each one's a little different. And there's a lot of people that have a lot of opinions about which is the right one.
Sure.
But again, you know, as the average workaday developer, you know, red, green, yellow are kind of, you know, good indicators, right, to not have to do it. How do you guys actually apply that, you know, here at Crow when you guys are developing software for your customers?
Sure. So just to step back a little bit, you have to kind of look at the whole process that we use in our development lifecycle. So the environment we've got is using Team Foundation System, which is the central component that provides that overall centralized server part that's got the source control work items, et cetera. So we've got 2005 edition of that and then 2008 versions of Visual Studio doing our development lifecycle. So all our developers have got their work items and stuff that they're going through, checking their code in, et cetera. We've got automated build process that runs that makes sure that everyone's got their code, compiles, does the automated deployment build, and then release out to the server to make sure that it's all working. So we go through a very rigorous and detailed kind of development process. And in the end, some of the things that we do is have just periodic QA tests right now of with some of the cyclomatic complexity things that unfortunately at the moment it's not baked into some of the automated build reports. I'm certainly looking forward to the day when that is. But at the moment, we just have periodic kind of quality milestones that we go through. Someone responsible for pulling up the code, just running that quick code metrics, code analysis, and tools, and then also doing a detailed kind of peer review of the overall code itself. So kind of using an automated plus a manual code review process as we go through and take a detailed look at code.
So that'd be generally somebody like a, you know, a dev lead, or maybe there's mm-hmm. the person responsible for code reviews on the project team, you know, would periodically just pull up and say, you know, let's check the complexity. They kind of, you kind of knew from a baseline standpoint what the last time you checked it was. So
correct.
Maybe you check it weekly. What kind of jump does it take for you guys to put on the brakes and go, whoa, let's get a team stand up together. Let's go in the conference room and let's talk about why our complexity jumped up so much.
Sure. We refer to those as the come to Jesus meeting, where you've got to say, oh, we got a problem. We got to go and get everyone on the same page and reduce that complexity. So we really just define it, and it varies by project. So we've got what we call a quality champion, that on every project up front, we define what our quality metrics and goals, what the acceptable thresholds are in comparison to the requirements of the project, and then define what that is. So, I mean, typically the variances of, well, if you got a 10 to 15 to 20% jump on anything, that starts to, you know, raise the alarm bells type of thing. But
unless it was tied to something correct. Specific, like, you know, you implemented a new, you know, functionality to calculate rates or something that is naturally complex because of the business right. domain.
Correct. I mean, that's a great point about it, is the tools will do and give you that quick check, but then it's up to you to really decide, well, what do I need to do with it? What action do I actually have to take? So there's the kind of the qualitative and the quantitative part of it as well. So the tool will handle the quantitative, and then you got to kind of go through and do the subjective look at what's really important, what's in bounds, what's out of bounds, and what we have to worry about.
So if a developer, you know, adds a new button onto a form, the complexity shouldn't jump up a whole lot. And if it does, that's more of a red flag than if, you know, we, you know, did some complex rating calculation that the customer specifically asked for.
Exactly. And one of the great things about that you just highlight is the developer themselves. Now they've got the tools using this that they can run that check themselves. So now it's not, you have to have the grand wizard, you know, sitting in the ivory tower that measures all this stuff. You can actually have every developer have those tools and things in their hand that ideally they're running that check right before they run the check their own code in themselves, so that they've already done some of that look and they already have a good idea what their code looks like to refactor it before they even turn it in the first time.
So we've talked about a lot of like in-flight process type mm-hmm. stuff, you know, so this is, you know, as the project's going along, but I'm sure that you guys have a multi-release situation with some of your clients where you'll do release one for 3 months, you know, the customer will have it, then they'll come back and ask for more functionality. Is there a checkpoint in there at the beginning of the maintenance project that says, you know, hey, let's look at the complexity, and because this is a minor maintenance release in this instance, we don't want to jump up the complexity by more than 5%. Is that some kind of, like, you know, metric that you guys held yourself accountable
we
to?
We do. We kind of refer to that as a multi-generational project plan, where we've got all kinds of, you even have to manage different code streams at that point and shelve different code as you kind of have different build releases and build dates. So with that, we'll start at the beginning any given project, come up with that baseline by running the tools of, here's what it is when we're starting, and then come up with that threshold of, okay, can it jump 5, 10, what percent? And we typically will try to go through and make sure that we either keep the same or decrease the amount of complexity within the code where possible, just to make sure that we're continuing to build that scalability and performance into the application.
Yeah, I don't think a lot of people realize, you know, the long-term cost, you know, mm-hmm. of, you know, a line of code or, you know, a branch. You know, I saw some amazing statistic. I think it was from a Forrester paper that, like, for every dollar that you put, you know, into a project as you're building it, you're actually creating $3.80 worth of work later. And that's, you know, that's a huge jump. And you can, if you consider that, you know, I spend, you know, 200-300 hours on a project, I mean, that is essentially what Forrester's saying, is you're creating a total of like 1,200, 1,400 hours of work long term. And I think a lot of that's related to the complexity of the software. If you can, you know, have simple software that doesn't increase the complexity and that's easy for somebody else to come in and maintain, you know, you're not going to have $3.80. You're going to have $2.40.
And that's the exact reason why, as we've talked here, not keep the word complexity keeps coming up over and over of the is across the many number of solutions that I've been involved with architecting. I've come to appreciate the, you know, the architecture of simplicity or lack of complexity, of the simpler the solution, the easier it is for someone else to pick it up and understand it. I've seen plenty of times where folks have, you know, implemented the MVP or other patterns. Challenges the other developers that come along, if they're not familiar with that pattern, can't pick it up, can't follow the same, you know, mantras and design practices and patterns, and in the end to produce something that, yeah, it may be elegant when you first touched it, but after a couple of, you know, multi-generational steps, it looks like garbage at that point because it's got a whole mixture of a bunch of different stuff within it.
So you mentioned, so we talked about a couple things. We talked about looking at metrics, you know, periodically, especially at the beginning of the project and setting goals. You also mentioned continuous integration, which I'm a huge champion of. You know, the quicker that you can find out that you broke the build, you know, the better. If you get it down to minutes, you know, or if you actually get it to the point where it happens as soon as you, you know, check in the code, you know, that's better. Any other best practices to share, you know, with people, you know, either running a development center like this or, you know, running, you know, their own organization, you know, at a customer site?
Yeah, so the continuous build part, I mean, there's a lot of best practices baked into that right there of just when you check in your code, enforcing those rules at check-in of your code's got to compile and it's got to adhere to this set of particular standards, because unfortunately we've fallen victim in the past to that, you know, practice in the morning, everyone gets the latest, so they're building off the latest build. Next thing you know, I've got 12 developers that all can't get latest because the guy that left at 1 in the morning last night checked in bum code. So then you got 11 other developers that are, you know, burning away an hour or two in the morning because they got bad code. So that continuous integration of forcing folks to check in code that compiles and then also adheres to standards has just been a huge gain for us in using the tools.
So do you guys do anything from a, you know, non-systematic technology tool standpoint to kind of, you know, enforce that? We used to have, you know, a bucket there, and if you broke the build, you had to throw in a dollar.
Yep, we had the dollar. We've had the dollar jar, and we have another fun mascot. We refer to the big boy that was a ripoff from the Frisch's big boy. We have a little statue that if you do something really stupid like, you know, drop the database or check in a bunch of bum code, you get nominated for the big boy, which is like a, you know, scarlet letter you get to carry around with you for a month till the somebody else earns it.
So you have to carry it around until the next person, you know.
Or at least at your desk or something, but you're the, you know, you get it and it becomes part of the history of you're recorded as having had the big boy at that particular point in time.
Yeah, so before coming to Microsoft, we didn't have something as elegant as the big boy statue. We actually had a plunger. And you literally had to, you know, you had to keep the plunger at your desk, you know, visible on site. And then for our daily stand-up meeting, you actually had to bring it with you.
You had to bring it with you. There you go.
Continuous integration improved our quality, you know, a lot. Enforcing the plunger took it to like 99.9%. It got to the point, actually it might have been counterproductive at some point because people were afraid to check in anything, you know, on the off chance that they were going to break the build because they didn't want the plunger.
That's quite humorous. We've had the similar benefit where now that we've got the, you know, continuous integration, anyone's ability to win money out of the dollar jar or whatever is gone because we don't have that anymore. So the other thing that I've actually done recently from a human engineering side of things is actually had a competition of solicit testing help from outside of the project team. It was basically the everyone else versus the development team. So basically for every bug you find in a report, you get a dollar. So I had a pool of money that, okay, at the end, this pool of money is going to someone. It's either going to all the testers or it's going to all the developer team to go basically have a party or go drink and do whatever with. So it's something we came up with just to kind of put a challenge out there to encourage people to write quality code.
That's interesting because you kind of turned the old Dilbert joke on its side because, you know, Wally was, you know, told Dilbert, it's like, we get paid $5 for every bug that we find. Right. And he says, I'm going to go write myself a minivan. Yeah. But what you said is, no, we're not going to let the developers find their own bugs. We're going to let, you know, the testers or an outside group, you know, and I think it's a great way to get volunteer
QA people. Volunteer testing. It was the cheapest testing I've ever done because basically at that point, by having a pool of money out there, well, I could have staffed 20 people on a project at, you know, billing rates, which you can imagine what that would amount up to, or just throw a challenge out to people, each one willing to spend an hour or two of their own time just to go participate in this fun thing. So it was the cheapest testing I've ever had, and also got a large community and some great results out of it.
Great. Anything else to share with the listeners?
We pretty much covered it.
Thanks for being on The Thirsty Developer.
Thanks for having me.
Wow, Larry, that really made my head spin. So the only question I have for you, two words. Cyclomatic complexity?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so cyclomatic complexity, that has to be the phrase that pays.
For this show, definitely, yes.
So if I had something to give away right now for cyclomatic complexity, I certainly would. But that actually, my head hurt a little bit when you said cyclomatic complexity. What exactly is cyclomatic complexity?
Okay.
By the way, I just love saying cyclomatic complexity. I'm going to be saying that, you know, for the next couple of days.
All right.
So cyclomatic complexity, what is it exactly?
So fundamentally, it's just a rating of how complex your code is. What they do is they analyze the number of loops that you go through and the number of times that you have controlled branches and uncontrolled branches.
You know, it's a measure that you can look at and say, you know, how complex is this code, and you can compare it to other code. So traditionally, there's a number that a piece of code is given, you know, between 1 and 200. I actually worked on a project before coming to Microsoft where we were testing cyclomatic complexity, and we actually had a program come back as cyclomatic complexity, you could say that three times, of 2,000. And we
is that good or is that bad?
2,000 is bad. That means extremely complex, right?
And so you're always trying to reach to zero, or what number are you trying to reach?
Well, zero would be the perfect cyclomatic complexity, but the application probably wouldn't do a lot.
Okay.
You know, so we would have no branching or anything like that. And that's just not, you know, pretty not feasible with a real application, right?
All right. So it's not necessarily an error count per se, but it's just right. Measuring, you know, the complexity of your application, meaning that the more complex your application is, the what? What are you trying to measure out of that?
The higher the number is. And it's a way to compare.
But what? Does that mean it's going to cost me more to maintain it or what?
Absolutely. And there's a steeper learning curve, you know, for somebody coming in who hasn't seen the code and hasn't worked with it before.
Okay.
And that's the key thing is when we ran into that program that had a cyclomatic complexity of 2,000, I asked somebody, it's like, well, what is this thing? And they said, oh, that program, you know, only Bill ever touches that because nobody else can understand it.
Got it. But you're making my head hurt way more than it was earlier. And I think we're going to have to wrap up this week's show on that note. So thanks, everybody, for listening. I will ask any feedback, suggestions, complaints, concerns of the show. Send them to thirstydeveloperalive.com. And as always, we welcome your comments for each show at thirstydeveloper.com. Once again, this is Dave Boss to my friend Larry Clarkin over there. You can reach myself at daveboss.com. You can reach Larry at larryclarkin.com. And you can find us both on Twitter and our Facebook. So we look for you all out there. And thanks for listening to the show, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to The Thirsty Developer. For more information, visit thirstydeveloper.com. We'll see you next time. We wanted to tell everybody about this event. This is the second time they've held a Silicon Prairie Social, and it's going to be on January 24th at Mullins Bar in Lyle, Illinois.